माधव कुंज बिहारी जय गोपी जन बल्लभ गिरिवर धारी जय गोपी जन बल्लभ गिरिवर धारी यशोर नंदना ब्रज जन रंदना यशोर नंदना ब्रज जन रंदना यमुना चीरवन चारी यमुना तीरवन चारी जय राध माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राध माधव कुंज बिहारी जय गोपी जन बल्लभ गिरिवर धारी जय गोपी जन बल्लभ गिरिवर धारी चंदन ब्रज जन रंजन यशोरानंदन ब्रज जन रंजन यमुन तीरवन चारी यमुन तीरवन चारी जय राध माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राध माधव कुंज बिहारी जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राजकाचार्य स्तोत्रस्तु श्री श्रीमद् इस डिवाइन ग्रेस लेसे भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी प्रभुपाद की जय कुंतराज श्रीमद् भागवत जय और भयमानंदे हरे हरि बोल समवेत भक्त वृंद आवेश असम्भल डिवोटी आगवेश दी असम्भल डिवोटी आगवेश दी असम्भल डिवोटी आगवेश श्री श्री गुरु गौरांग ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 15, Description of the Kingdom of God, text number 45. We're spending a few days on this verse because it has a long purport. The word meanings, pungsam of those persons, gatim, liberation, mrigayatam, who are searching iha, here in this world, yoga margai, by the process of ashtanga yoga, dhyana aspadam, object of meditation, bahu, by the great yogis, matam, approved, nayana, eyes, abhiramam, pleasing, pungsnam, human, vapu, form, darshayanam, displaying, and others, siddhai, perfected, otpattikai, eternally present, samagrinan, praised, yutam, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is endowed, ashtabhogai, with eight kinds of achievement. Pungsam gatim mrigayatam iha yoga margair. Dhyanaspadam bahumatam nayanabhiramam. Pungsnam vapur darshayanam ananya siddhair. That line seems to be a little bit irregular, so you have to pause a little bit after the vapur. Autpattikai samagrinan yutam ashtabhogai. Pungsam gatim mrigayatam iha yoga margair. Dhyanaspadam bahumatam nayanabhiramam. Pungsnam vapur darshayanam ananya siddhair. See, it's darshayanam, not darshayanam. Darshayanam. Vapur darshayanam ananya siddhair. Autpattikai samagrinan yutam ashtabhogai. Jnanaspadam bahumatam nayanabhiramam. Pungsnam vapur darshayanam ananya siddhaya. Otpattikai samagrinan ashtabhogai. Pungsam gatim mrigayatam iha yoga margai. Dhyanaspadam bahumatam nayanabhiramam. Pungsnam vapur darshayanam ananya siddhaya. Autpattikai samagarnam yutam ashtabhogai. Pungsam gatim mrigayatam iha yoga margai. Utpattikai samagarnan yutamashtabogai Om Sangatim Megayatam Yoga Margai Janas Padam Bahumatam Nayanabhiramam Pungsnam Vapur Dashayanam Ananya Siddhaya Utpattikai Samagarnan Yutam Ashtabogai Pungsam Gatim Megayatam Iha Yoga Margai Dhyanas Padam Bahumatam Nayanabhiramam Pungsnam Vapur Dashayanam Ananta Siddhaya Utpattikai Samagarnan Yutamashtabogai Pungsam Gatim Rigayatam Iha Yoga Margai Dhyanas Padam Pungsnam Vapur Darshayanam Anam Siddhair Utpattikai Samagrinam Yutam Ashtabogai
Manumati, you want to show us how to pronounce it? There's one syllable missing. Yeah. 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 In other words, you don't. Yeah. Then you don't. Otherwise, you don't get that long A in the right place. Darshayanam. You need to look at the short A's and long A's. That's how you get the meter of the verse. Pungsam vapur darshayanam ananya bhut siddhay.
Okay, so we'll go with translation. This is the form of the Lord.
So we just heard about the Lord's form, some of it.
This is the form of the Lord which is meditated upon by the followers of the yoga process.
In other words, the form that the four Kumaras are seeing, Lord Vishnu.
And it is pleasing to the yogis in meditation. It is not imaginary but factual, as proved by great yogis. The Lord is full in eight kinds of achievement, but for others these achievements are not possible in full perfection. The narrator at this point is Lord Brahma. He's talking to the demigods. So Srila Prabhupada's purport, we're continuing. Yesterday we did two paragraphs. You may have noticed in Prabhupada's books that the tendency these days is to have short paragraphs. Prabhupada's paragraphs tend to be quite long, and that's because the transcribers, they only put paragraphs in when Prabhupada said para in his dictation. When he said para, then you put in a paragraph. So he didn't do that very often. We have these long paragraphs. So this says third paragraph of this purport by Srila Prabhupada. 5,000 years ago, Lord Krishna recommended yoga practice to Arjuna. But Arjuna frankly expressed his inability to follow the stringent rules and regulations of the yoga system. One should be very practical in every field of activities and should not waste his valuable time in practicing useless gymnastic feats in the name of yoga. Real yoga is to search out the four-handed supersoul within one's heart and see him perpetually in meditation. Such continued meditation is called samadhi, and the object of this meditation is the four-handed mena, the bodily decorations as described in this chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam. If, however, one wants to meditate upon something void or impersonal, it will take a very long time before he achieves success in yoga practice. We cannot concentrate our mind on something void or impersonal. Real yoga is to fix the mind on the form of the Lord, the four-handed Narayana who is sitting in everyone's heart. By meditation, one can understand that God is seated within one's heart. Even if one does not know it, God is seated within the heart of everyone. Not only is he seated in the heart of the human being, but he is also within the hearts of cats and dogs. Bhagavad Gita certifies this fact by the declaration of the Lord, Ishvara Sarva Bhutanam Hridayeshu. The Ishvara, the supreme controller of the world, is seated in the heart of everyone. Not only is he in everyone's heart, but he is also present within the atom. No place is vacant or devoid of the presence of the Lord. That is the statement of Ishopanishad. God is present everywhere, and his right of proprietorship applies to everything. The feature of the Lord by which he is present everywhere is called Paramatma. Atma means the individual soul, and Paramatma means the individual supersoul. Both Atma and Paramatma are individual persons. The difference between Atma and Paramatma is that the Atma, or the soul, is present only in a particular body, whereas the Paramatma is present everywhere. In this connection, the example of the sun is very nice. An individual person may be situated in one place, but the sun, even though a similar individual entity, is present on the head of every individual person. This is explained. Therefore, even though the qualities of all entities, including the Lord, are equal, the supersoul is different from the individual soul by quantitative power of expansion. The Lord or the supersoul can expand himself into millions of different forms, whereas the individual soul cannot do so. Om Jnana Timirantasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sarva Vedanta Saram Hi Srimad Bhagavatam Ishyate Tad Visamrita Triptyasya Nanyatyasyat Kati Vachit. That's a verse glorifying the Bhagavatam. It's the Sarva Vedanta Saram. It's the essence of all Vedic knowledge. Srimad Bhagavatam Ishyate Tadrasamata Triptasya Nanyatyasyat Kati Vachit. Anyone who tastes Srimad Bhagavatam, develops a taste for it, will have no taste for any other literature. So today I think I'm just going to go through this purport, at least some of it, scrutinizingly study the purport, look at it very closely. Actually, probably repeat some of the things that we just heard yesterday in the purport, some of the same points, which is not uncommon in his presentations. Repetition is the key to learning, so we have to hear things over and over again. So the first sentence here, 5,000 years ago, Lord Krishna recommended yoga practice to Arjuna, but Arjuna frankly expressed his inability to follow the stringent rules and regulations of the yoga system. First thing I thought about this sentence was there are certain assumptions. Srila Prabhupada is a speaker already. And he's making allusions. You make a reference to something without directly stating it. So you have to be somewhat in the know to understand what's being referred to. For example, in literature, sometimes people will make an allusion to something from Shakespeare, for example. So unless you're learned in Shakespeare, you may not get it, you know. So here, 5,000 years ago, so what's the big deal about why 5,000 years ago, right? Well, we all know why 5,000 years ago, because that's when Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita, 5,000 years ago. Of course, even that is a revolutionary idea, because nobody thinks these kinds of things went on 5,000 years ago. But we take it as a given. So 5,000 years ago, Lord Krishna recommended yoga practice to Arjuna. So what's the context? Well, that's the Bhagavad Gita he's talking about here. You may not understand that. He recommended the yoga practice to Arjuna. This is something, too, I always wonder about, I think. Did Krishna really recommend the yoga practice to Arjuna? The whole time he's telling him, no, you can't become a yogi, you can't become a sannyasi. You're supposed to fight. So how is he recommending the yoga practice to him? It doesn't seem like he's actually recommending it. Which makes you wonder, well, why is he telling him all this stuff about yoga? It seems like he's just teaching the world or through Arjuna. Well, here's an opportunity. I'll tell everyone about yoga. But I don't really expect Arjuna to do it. And then, of course, Arjuna says, I don't think I could do it. Which is also, this is something we understand from here. Why is it significant that Arjuna said he couldn't understand it? Both the time, 5,000 years ago, and the character of Arjuna indicates something about how hard it is. 5,000 years ago, people were a lot better off than we are. They didn't have the same kinds of distractions. They didn't have the messed up minds that we have in Kali Yuga. So many things that they had going for them, culture and so on. So 5,000 years ago, people were better off to practice yoga, as Krishna's recommending, supposedly. And also Arjuna, he was among the elite. He was, you know, one of the leaders of the world, one of the most qualified persons on the planet at that time. And even he said, I don't think I can do it. So here, you could say this Prabhupada is, without coming right out and saying all these things, he's implying these things when he spoke this sentence. So then he goes on, one should be very practical in every field of activities. So I thought, well, that's just Prabhupada's giving practical advice here in every field of activity. Be practical. Prabhupada wanted us to be practical, of course, in all our endeavors. So the devotee is expert in everything, in so many things. I like this, in one letter Prabhupada was writing to one of his leaders. I don't remember if it was Sannyasi or GBC, it was early. And he said, I want all our leaders to be expert preachers and expert managers. And that's a difficult thing, actually. For most of I always think of this idea of Raji. As a Raja, Raja means has a lot of Raja, mode of passion. So to be a Raja and a Rishi at the same time, it's like, how do they both fit in the same person, in the same head? How can you have both of those characteristics? It's a very difficult thing. The Prabhupada expected that. He wanted devotees to be expert in different ways. And of course, he himself demonstrated it. He was an expert manager, very meticulous about everything that he did. He was very practical in every field of activities, as he says here. And of course, he was a Rishi, obviously, presenting the teachings of Lord Krishna for us to understand. So go to this sentence again. One should be very practical in every field of activities and should not waste his valuable time in practicing useless gymnastic feats in the name of yoga. So the first part of the sentence is a lead into the second part. The context is we're talking about yoga here. And this is one of course, Prabhupada's ways of deprecating ordinary yoga practice, useless gymnastic feats. So it's a real put down of people who think they're yogis, but what are they? You can go over to the local gym and watch the gymnasts doing their practices. It's just as good as your yoga. In other words, more or less, he's suggesting the same thing. They're doing their tumbling and their twirling and whatever they do, and you're doing your yoga practice, but it's a waste of time. I don't know if you know, there's a the book that the prescribes yoga practice by the authority. Of course, Bhagavad Gita and Krishna are the authority, but Patanjali, that's his field, among the six Vedic philosophies, Patanjali taught yoga. He taught the Yoga Sutras. So the Yoga Sutras aren't about Hatha Yoga. They're not about twisting like a pretzel and all these kinds of things. They're about the mind, really. Yoga Chitta Nivritti Nirodha. Yoga, this is the second verse of the Yoga Sutras. Yoga means, it was probably translated, yoga means to control the mind. Vritti is all the agitation that goes on within our minds. Chitta means mind, or our inner self, mind, intelligence, and ego. So that's what yoga is about. So that's what's taught, actually, in the Yoga Sutras, at least in the earlier part of it. There's a devotee. He's a scholar, Edwin Bryant. Some of you may have heard of him. He teaches at Rutgers University. His name is Advaita Prabhu Das, and he wrote a commentary on the Yoga Sutras. It's very nice, actually, this detail of how the whole subtle body works, because that's the yoga that really focuses on that. So that point is there. That's really what the Yoga Sutras are about. They're about how to control the mind, how the whole thing works. They also talk about the mystic cities, which are mentioned here in this verse, actually. Ashtabogai, eight kinds of achievement. Okay, going on. Real yoga is to search out the four-handed super soul within one's heart and see him perpetually in meditation. So this, again, this is a point that Prabhupada would make repeatedly. What is yoga? It's not whatever you think it is. It's about finding the super soul within the heart. And Prabhupada would quote this one line, dhyana vastita tadgatena manasa pasyantiyam yogino. This is a line from a verse. It's actually in the Bhagavatam, but it appears in the Vedic literature. And Prabhupada, at least in one place I heard him on a morning walk, he quoted this verse. It begins, yang brahma varendra rudra marutai stunvanti divyai stavai vedai sangha padakramo panishadair gayanti yang samaga. And so the third line is just jnana vastita tadgatena manasa pasyanti yam yogino. By the way, this meter is the same as the Shad Goswami Ashtaka meter. It's called, what is it, Vikrita? What is the second word? I'm forgetting it. Yeah, anyway, it means the play of the lion. That's what this meter is called. So anyway, Prabhupada quoted this verse. He would quote this third line of this verse. This verse, by the way, just a little sidebar here. Some of you old-timers may remember many years ago, Ridayananda Maharaj had a debate with his professor, Professor Bharati. Remember that? It was quite heated, actually, at some point. This Professor Bharati said, Ridayananda, you are lying! So when he started, he quoted this verse, Yam Brahma Varunendra Rudra Marutai, which of course we take as person of the Lord, but he was an impersonalist. So anyway, that's one context. I heard this verse many years ago. So again, Prabhupada would quote this line, Dhyana Vastita Tadgatena Manasyana Pasyanti Yam Yogino. The yogis are supposed to, Dhyana, that word appears here in this verse. Dhyana means meditation, but not meditation on anything, which is what the point Prabhupada is going to come to now. Real yoga is to search out the four-handed super soul within one's heart and see him perpetually in meditation. First you have to find him, and then you fix your mind on him. Such continued meditation is called samadhi, which of course is the highest of the Ashtanga yoga, the highest stage. And the object of this meditation is the fara, whose bodily decorations are described in this chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam. If, however, one wants to meditate upon something void or impersonal, it will take a very long time before he achieves such yoga practice. So this is a whole concoction, actually, this idea. In fact, when we read, I've been reading the commentaries of both Baladeva Vidyabhushan and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur to the Bhagavad Gita. And Prabhupada tends to connect everything to bhakti yoga, whereas these commentators, they talk about, you know, other kinds of yoga, jnana and yoga more specifically. and they give some details about it. So the idea you get there is that not that they're meditating on something impersonal or void, but they're just trying to stop the mind. That's what they're trying to do. That their meditation, they're not consciously trying to think about the void. It's at least that doesn't come through in what I was reading. Because as Prabhupada says here, we cannot concentrate our mind on something void or impersonal. How can you fix your mind on nothing? You have to have something. There has to be an object of meditation to concentrate on the void. That's why Prabhupada says it's impractical. You can't really do it. I think they have these little yogis. I never was into yoga before as a devotee, but I know they sometimes prescribe these different practices, like make your mind like like a blackboard. And then if any thoughts come, then you just take out your eraser and you erase the blackboard. That's how you try to get rid of your thoughts. You know, these little techniques they have supposedly going to help you. But then you're thinking of the blackboard and the eraser, and you're thinking of something. You're not thinking of nothing. So as Prabhupada says, we cannot concentrate our mind on something void or impersonal. Real yoga is to fix the mind on the form of the Lord, the four-handed Narayana who's sitting in everyone's heart. So how much nicer it is to meditate on the form of the Lord. Prabhupada says it's described in this chapter. It's not described in much detail, but it's described in more detail in other places. One of the nicest meditations on the form of the Lord is the form meditation on the form of Lord Vishnu, as given in the Bhagavatam, in the teachings of Kapiladeva. He's instructing about yoga. So he goes into some detail. One thing I always find interesting is how decorated the Lord is, Lord Vishnu. He has, his epaulets or shoulders, something on his shoulder. I don't think it's mentioned there, but in other places. And he has armlets, and he has bracelets, and he has anklets, and he has a girdle, or it's a belt or a girdle. Sometimes it's described as a belt, and sometimes it's the translation I just came across, it says it's kind of like it covers the loins and the hips. So the loins means like a loincloth, covers that middle part of the body. And then, of course, it's dazzling gold. And you hear about his Kaustubha gem, which is dazzling. The Kaustubha gem, by the way, is the source or the representation of the jivas. So Krishna has the jivas close to his heart in the Kaustubha gem. And then you have the Srivatsa mark, the curling line that represents Lakshmi Devi. She's always on the chest of the Lord. It's funny, sometimes you hear a description, the Lord is arriving with Lord Vishnu on his chest. You think, I wonder what that looks like. Instead of giving a piggyback ride, he's giving her a chest ride. So that generally means that she's accompanying him. Or if she's not, of course she always is. She's there somehow. And then she's there represented, of course, as the curling line in his chest. Then we hear, often it's described, we don't usually hear about turbans with Lord Vishnu. Krishna wears a turban because it's more a rural thing, and he decorates it with all kinds of natural things. But usually when you hear about Vishnu, it's described as a helmet or a crown, usually Lord Vishnu wears. But it's dazzling gold. Of course, everything is dazzling gold. Even his dhoti, Krishna is described like this too. His dhoti is like lightning. What is it? Anyway, Lord Brahma, when he sees, after he goes through his whole experience with Krishna, he's glorifying Krishna, then he describes, he says, it's like lightning accompanying a cloud, because Krishna is the color of a cloud, and then you have the lightning. His dhoti is like, his dhoti is like the lightning accompanying the cloud. So it's often described that his yellow dhoti is effulgent. And I was just reading the other day, we often hear, well, we know Lord Balaram, he expands his different paraphernalia of the Lord, like his asan and his bed and his shoes, I think, are mentioned. But in one place, I think it was in the commentary of Sanatan Goswami, Vaishnav Toshini commentary, he says his ornament and his garments. So Krishna dhoti is also an expansion of Balaram, which I thought was interesting. I don't know if I had heard that before. I mean, I thought his asan and different things. But even his dhoti. Of course, Krishna and Balaram, in one sense, are one. So Krishna's dhoti, everything connected with Krishna is Krishna. So Balaram is Krishna too, in a certain sense. So anyway, this are there in the teachings of Lord Kapila. It's a very beautiful meditation on the form of Lord Vishnu. And that's also described there about his smiling face. You always hear that Krishna, when he appears, he has a smiling face. He's never depressed. Krishna never has a depressed face. He's always cheerful looking. And that in itself enlivens the devotees. And sometimes, of course, we have in the Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, Nectar of Devotion, different expressions on Krishna's face, and the devotees also as they interact with Krishna. You know, they have names for them, Hasita, Asita, and whatever, I forget the names of them all these categories. Bhaktivedanta Sindhu is full of so many categories. So there it says, we hear sometimes you get to see Krishna's teeth, which are sometimes described as like pomegranate seeds. Because pomegranate seeds are, you know, they're reddish, and Krishna always chews betel, and he has a reddish tint on his beautiful white teeth. And so many things. His toenails are like rubies. I notice on the deities tend to have their toenails painted white. I guess that's the standard. That's just done that way. But usually Krishna's toenails are described as rubies, so bright red toenails. Anyway, so real yoga is to fix the mind on the form of the Lord, the four-handed Narayana who is sitting in everyone's heart. By meditation, one can understand that God is seated within one's heart. Even if one does not know it, God is seated within the heart of everyone. So I thought this was a very nice point, too. We don't know it. He's right there. We don't know it. And it's not only the yogi that doesn't know it. We don't know it either. We know that Paramatma is there, and if we have enough devotion, then Shyama Sundar will be there. One thing I was just noticing in reading the commentaries of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. In many places, as I was saying, he tends to talk in kind of a general way, maybe. But then when he talks about, Krishna is specifically talking about himself here. Shyama Sundar, wearing yellow clothing. So it comes up repeatedly throughout his commentaries. Every time he talks about Krishna, he says, Shyama Sundar. Prabhupada also does that in certain places. One place, I'm pretty sure if I remember correctly, is when the Mahishis, the queens in Dwarka, that famous section where they're doing this Chitra Jalpa and Prajalpa, all these different Jalpas and all their prayers. So they refer to Krishna as Shyama Sundar. So I looked it up and it wasn't in the sense. Prabhupada translates it as Shyama Sundar when they're referring to Krishna. So it seemed like Prabhupada liked the name Shyama Sundar also. Of course, he named Radharani in Vrindavan, Radha Shyama Sundar in Vrindavan, his home. So the Lord is seated within one's heart, but we don't see him. Namasye purusham tvajam ishvaram prakate param malaksham sarvabhutanam antarbahiravastitam. That's the first of Kunti Devi's prayers. You're situated inside everything, and you're outside too, but still we don't see you anywhere. Prabhupada used to say for the non-devotees, they can't see Krishna anywhere. And for the devotees, they can't not see Krishna anywhere. They see him everywhere. Devotees are seeing everywhere, and the non-devotees don't see him anywhere. So then Prabhupada goes on. Not only is he seated in the heart of the human being, but he is also within the hearts of cats and dogs. Bhagavad Gita certifies this fact by the declaration of the Lord, Ishvara Sarva Bhutanam Hridayeshi. So again, this is Prabhupada is implying here, because Bhagavad Gita says it, therefore it's true. The Ishvara, the supreme controller of the world, is seated in the heart of everyone. He's also present within the atom. No place is vacant or devoid of the presence of the Lord. So these are astounding things. Of course, we hear them over and over again, but people don't know these things. God is, they may even say God is everywhere, but they have some really vague idea what does that mean exactly. But he is actually within the atom, literally everywhere, within everything. God is present, I like this phrase. God is present everywhere, and his right of proprietorship applies to everything. So sometimes people go to court to fight over who has the right of proprietorship. Like a couple may get divorced and they may go to court. One may say, no, it's mine. And the other one say, no, it's mine. So they're fighting over the right of proprietorship. So Prabhupada is saying here, his right of proprietorship applies to everything. Actually, it's not either one of yours, it's Krishna's. All of your assets belong to Krishna. He has the right of proprietorship. And the proof is he can take everything away from you in a moment. That shows how he owns it. He can steal it from you, and he does, of course. Even your own body, which you think you own, he steals that too. So then he and Paramatma, and he gives, basically that's the final point of this paragraph where he talks about these two forms of the Lord. I like this also, this sentence where he says, an individual person maybe, oh no. Anyway, he talks about individual person, oh here it is. Atma means the individual soul, and Paramatma means the individual super soul. Both Atma and Paramatma are individual persons. So individual souls, there are so many individual souls, but Paramatma is an individual too. He's not the conglomeration of all these other individuals. He himself is an individual too. And of course, then Prabhupada explains the difference between the two. So you can see how you can talk about these things for a while. As Prabhupada said, you could take one verse and speak on it for months. So let me just read, well, I guess I'll just stop. You're going to hear the translation for the next few days again. And the verse, as I was reading this, I was thinking, traditionally people would hear it maybe once and then be able to repeat it. But we'll hear it 50 times and we still won't have memorized it yet. You know, this practice that we have would probably give us doing word for word. Now, I don't do it, I do it line by line. But some devotees still do word by word. The reason it started that way was because in the very beginning, there was nothing written on the board. Prabhupada introduced Bhagavatam class, and devotees were listening, and they had to repeat what Prabhupada said. So that's why Prabhupada did word by word. And then he would say, no, 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 no. Then he would say it again, and he would try to get them to pronounce it exactly right. But so they were just hearing them. They weren't seeing anything. So I'm thinking now we're able to see it. Maybe it's not necessary to go word by word. You know, before we do line by line. At least that's my rationale for not doing it that way. Anyway, so any questions, comments, confusions? Yes, Prabhu.
You mentioned that Arjuna really wasn't interested to follow that yoga system, but Krishna arranged such a way that the right questions for the benefit of all the other conditioned souls. Mm-hmm. And just moving ahead, Prithu Maharaj, after he enjoyed his kingdom and performed so many wonderful activities, he and Archie went to the forest and performed some very severe austerities. I mean, you know, eating leaves and just drinking water, and then in the heat, you know, getting in hot fires all around in the cold, and it seems, why would they, you know, like recommend such severity of austerity if the chanting of the holy name could be introduced at any time? And why would they show that kind of practice as emperor of the world, a powerful incarnation, all of a sudden living in the forest, renouncing everything, and performing some incredibly unbelievable austerities?
Well, part of it is just, it was just the tradition. It was the way you did things. At the end of your life, you cast off in a very kind of dramatic way all your attachments to the material world. That seems to be the idea. One thing I find really interesting is it Yudhishthir? I think it's Yudhishthir where it's described. Because, you know, we had this explanation about how merge all the senses and the sense organs into the self, and basically they're destroying them somehow. So it's described like that. Then it says, and then he left home. I was like, oh, I thought he just got rid of his whole body piece by piece. But apparently, it's some kind of subtle thing that's going on. It's really kind of, the whole thing is really mystical. What's more surprising, of course, that Prithu Maharaj, he was such an exalted person. He was a devotee, obviously. He was a great devotee. Yeah, he could have just chanted Hare Krishna. There's some reason that he did it. But what I find really amazing is that Dhritarashtra did it. That's whoa. I never heard of him practicing yoga. Yeah, he didn't become, but he practices yoga. Another thing that's amazing about this is, he's revealing, Narada reveals everything in the Bhagavatam. So he says in 5 days from now, basically, he'll get liberation or something. I'm thinking, 5 days? How did they go from Hastinapur to the Himalayas, two blind people? I was thinking maybe his wife took her bandage off to walk there. 5 days? Maybe 5 days of Brahma. I never understood that one. This is the kind of thing you see. What do the commentators say? And then they don't say anything. They say, oh.
Then it was seven days, wasn't it?
No, it says 5 days.
5 days. Yeah. But he didn't do it before he left town. I mean, he did it.
No, that was Yudhishthir. Either Yudhishthir or Rishabhdev, it says. I'm pretty sure Yudhishthir. You can look at it.
Well, maybe.
He did it before he left home. He merged this into that whole thing.
But I was just gonna, like you were saying about Vishwanath not mentioning that they meditate and avoid, but it's right in the Gita in the 12th chapter, right? That klesho digataraste sham, that those who meditate, avyakta sakta cheta sam, klesho, that's very difficult. I mean, Krishna is directly saying it. So, yeah. Plus, I mean, when you think speed up 300 years from the time of Vishwanath or 200 or 300 years, I mean, this is what people do now. They go way off a candle, or they have some specific weird deviation. Maybe in Vishwanath and Baladev's time, they didn't. At that time, they had another type of thing. But even in Gita, Krishna talks about avyaktas, those whose minds are attached to the impersonal.
You know, this is something I just came across too in reading the commentaries. And in that section where Arjuna says it's too difficult, and Krishna says, well, you can do it by practice. And then Arjuna asks, well, what happens if you don't make it in this life? Do you lose everything? You lost all your material benefits because you became a Hare Krishna, and then you fell down, and so you lost there too. But, you know, the yogi. So that, of course, Krishna describes two kinds of yogis. One who practiced a little bit will go to the heavenly planets and then get a good birth. And one who has practiced longer will take birth in a family of yogis, basically. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentaries, he says, because then it says, well, Krishna says, that then you'll be natural, or the yogi will be naturally attracted, even against his will, to practice yoga. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, the second time around, he'll be serious, and then he'll practice for many lifetimes, and then he'll get perfection. So the way it's written there, I read it a few times, he makes it sound as if you slip up in one life, the yogi, and then the next time you're so determined you don't slip again. You don't slip up again. That's the way Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur characterizes it. And of course, then he still says, and of course, Krishna says, Bahunam Janmanam Ante Jnanavanman Prabhujade. The Jnani or Yogi, sometimes these get, actually Jnana leads to yoga. That's one theme that the commentators are often emphasizing. So
one
I thought that was interesting. It's the
one
way
thing about
he
that conversation
it.
With Bharati, that in retrospect, Kridanda didn't know that verse. He could have smashed him on that because it says they're all worshiping Krishna, those people, young Brahma, Varananda. And if he knew that, he would have just thrown it right at him because the guy was saying that, no, there are so many gods or some weirdo thing. But yeah, he could have just smashed him. He was the smartest guy we had.
Trivikram Prabhu.
So the yoga system for the different ages are different. Somewhere I read that, like for example, in Satyagwan lives for 100,000 years. So meditation, it takes a long time. So it's engagement for the jivas. Because like in Kali Yuga we're doing chanting, but because our lifespan is so short, chanting is the best means to achieve the goal. Whereas in Satyuga, meditation would have been the best means to attain the supreme being, and like that. I don't know if that touches upon this problem.
I always wonder where it's stated that how long people live in different ages. It's not in the Bhagavatam. Now, Prabhupada would sometimes say, he would talk about Vishwamitra Muni, who meditated for 60,000 years. In that context, he would say people lived 100,000 years. But it's not written in the Bhagavatam. I don't know where that comes from, that idea. It seems like it's like you're saying, maybe it's written in one of the other scriptures. But it may also be a kind of assumption based on other kinds of evidence, how long people lived in different ages. Yeah. And some of them are really like Bharat Maharaj. Bharat Maharaj is interesting. I forget, it says something about so many are Buddhas of years, which is an extremely long time. It's longer than Satyayuga. So you think, now one thing we're told, and I've read the Acharyas say this, these numbers, you don't have to take them literally. They often mean just a really long time. You know? Just like we might say millions, man, I've been waiting for you for millions of years or something, you know. So that kind of thing seems to be there. It's just take it as a lot. Otherwise, you wonder, well, why is everything a round figure? Why is it always 100 years and not 98 years? You know, and they had so many children, which is, there's one person who had like so many billions of children, the genealogy. Anyway, sometimes these things are, you know, the Acharyas, they kind of put the pieces together to help us understand. They may not be stated directly, or they have, of course, within their hearts, they have realization of things that may not be stated exactly. Or they're seeing Vedic literature that's not available to the ordinary person because they're seers, they're rishis. Anyway, that's just something I wondered about. Where does it talk about this 100? Oh, I was going to say about Bharat Maharaj also, it said he ruled this long, long, long time. But at the end of the whole pastime of Bharat Maharaj, his three births, so then it says, there's this verse that describes how he left home in his youth. Really? He was the king for millions of years, and then he was still a young man when he went to the forest? Okay. He's eternally young, I guess, the idea. Like, if you read about Shukadeva Goswami, I was wondering about this, and then I came across this stated somewhere, that Shukadeva Goswami is always 16 years old. Because he appears earlier in the Bhagavatam, he's 16. I think of the passing of Bhishma Dev, he's mentioned. Then at the end also, when he meets Shukadeva Goswami, he's still 16 years old. So he's eternally 16 years old. Navayovana, Shukadeva Goswami. All right, Madhamati Prabhu.
So when Krishna told, when Arjun said, I can't concentrate my mind, the mind is flickering. And so Krishna says, yes, through practice and renunciation, you can. So did Krishna, I guess my question is, did Krishna expect him to control his mind? Because then later on, he says in the chapter, yoginam api sarvesham, yeah, that through bhakti, that's the topmost. So my question is, did Krishna expect him to do so?
I don't think Krishna expected him that he was going to practice yoga. Now, Krishna, of course, the
specifically about mind control.
Certain characteristics, yeah, just like that. Just like, of course, what is Krishna telling Arjuna to fight and remember me? That's how he's telling him to control his mind. Mm-hmm. And abhyasa yoga yuktena, abhyasa means practice. So Krishna was expecting him to, in some sense, be a yogi. He told him, be a yogi, right? But then he said, the greatest yogi is my devotee. So being a yogi means that whatever qualifications or qualities or characteristics a yogi might have, good qualities, strengths and so on, then the bhakti yoga should also have those things. So it seems that it can be inferred that Krishna is telling Arjuna these things I'm talking to you about, yoga, they also apply to bhakti yoga, the bhakti yogi. Of course, you have to have a controlled mind to practice bhakti yoga.
I guess the question, reason I'm asking this question is specifically about chanting japa. And so it seems like, I'm trying to understand what is bhakti in relationship to japa? Because sometimes it seems like it's about mind control, and
yeah.
I don't think so. What is the difference when we're chanting japa? We're not yogis in the sense of we control our mind, but then just now you mentioned a point that for bhakti.
Yeah, although it does seem that there is, you know, a principle, just like Krishna says, when the mind wanders and you have to drag it back. So obviously we have to do that. Now sometimes devotees explain, which is a very nice point, is that if you have heart control, I don't know if they use this term, but if you have heart control, then you'll have mind control. If your heart is controlled, if your heart is placed at the lotus feet of Krishna, Krishna is there in your heart, then your mind will be controlled automatically. That's the idea. Of course, it means you'll have some relish for chanting, and you won't want to stop thinking, and you won't want to stop hearing and meditating on Krishna's holy name. Of course, you also have the experience of Krishna. So the mind is controlled in that way. Really, ultimately, that's what our practice is, awakening our attraction to Krishna. Then so many of these other things, they happen automatically. Your mind is controlled. I mean, Prabhupada would say that like Ambarish Maharaj, he did so many things, but his mind was fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna. But all those things that he did helped him to do that, to fix his mind on Krishna. So we're controlling our mind, but of course it does, you know, this is sadhana bhakti, so you do what you can to apply and follow the practice as well as possible. Whatever works, whatever helps. All right. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.